KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today we're doing another live show. Always a tricky thing for Hearsay Culture, because oftentimes I'm operating by telephone, or I do have people on the other side of the glass, but today I actually have another brave guest who's willing to go live on air with no editing or what have you. Today I'm very excited to have on Tony Falzone, who's the director of the Fair Use Project at Stanford Law School. Occasionally I do have the opportunity to interview my colleagues, and in fact next week you're going to hear a pre-recorded interview with Jennifer Granick and Brad Stone. Jennifer is the executive director of CIS and my boss, and Tony Falzone is the director of the Fair Use Project, and I also work for Tony. So yet again, I'm interviewing someone who controls my fate more or less, so I'll be very careful. But I am excited to have Tony on today. Tony joined Stanford last fall and is heading up the Fair Use Project, which is designed to really take a look hard at the fair use problems and fair use law issues that are confronting everyone from documentary filmmakers to musicians to artists and really anyone that has in any way endeavored to attempt to use copyrighted materials without getting express permission. The fair use doctrine is something that we have discussed on Hearsay Culture with a number of guests, and I'm very excited to have Tony on today to discuss the Fair Use Project, some of its projects, and really delve a little bit more into the fair use doctrine itself and what Tony thinks it is and what it should be. Tony is the executive director and has a background as an intellectual property litigator, and has defended writers, publishers, filmmakers, musicians, and video game makers on a variety of intellectual property issues, not just copyright. He was involved with a case which we will discuss a little bit today involving Professor Carol Schloss. And prior to coming to Stanford, he was a litigation partner in the San Francisco office of Bingham McCutcheon. He graduated from Harvard in 1997 and was a law clerk to the Honorable Barry Moskowitz of the District Court in the Southern District of California. So today we're going to be having kind of a practical discussion of fair use, because given the work that the Fair Use Project does, it is very much hands-on and on the ground dealing with litigation. So we're going to take a short music break, and when we return, we will start the discussion with Tony Falzone, the director of the Fair Use Project, on Hearsay Culture. On the other side of the glass, I'm joined today with Tony Falzone. Tony, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's start right off with kind of, before we get into what is fair use, I think it would be helpful to kind of explore a little more detail your background, what you did that led you to coming to Stanford and wanting to dedicate your time dealing with fair use issues.
How did I get here? Yes. Well, when I was in private practice in litigation, I had various opportunities to work with clients ranging from book publishers to video game makers, and it so happened that the kinds of cases I got were cases that, although they didn't implicate fair use per se, had a lot to do with whether somebody could come along and say, hey, you can't do that, you can't publish that, you can't make that game, you can't make that movie. And I found it galling, actually. People would run around and come and say, well, you can't make that movie because it was my idea and you stole it from me. Or they might come along and say, you can't make that video game because it includes animated footage of Albert Einstein in it. And we, the Einstein estate, control his likeness even though he's been dead for who knows how long.
Right.
And the issues were both fun and interesting, and really got to the core of the amount of creative freedom we're going to let people have, whether they are book publishers, big companies, Fortune 500 companies that make video games, or individual musicians, artists, and writers.
The your background as a litigation partner at a large firm, I'm sure, influences a lot of your thinking in this area, and I'm curious to get your sense to kind of start things off. When we talk about fair use and litigation of fair use cases, how widespread do you think fair use litigation is today in terms of its prevalence in the intellectual property practice area?
Well, it's certainly becoming more and more prevalent. It might not surprise you to hear litigators say there's not enough of it.
Right.
But let me explain that. I think one of the problems is that a lot of the people who have the most compelling fair use issues lack the means to pursue litigation if and when that becomes necessary. And so although a lot of fair use law is built on the backs of disputes between relatively big companies or at least folks who tend to have a lot of money, the smaller folks, the folks who are less well off and lack the resources, often have to fold up and go home just as soon as they get a threat. It's one of the reasons the Fair Use Project exists, to try to change that dynamic. And so I do think that although it might strike you as kind of funny to say the world needs more litigation, I think the world does need more of this kind of litigation, because at the end of the day, it's what vindicates creative freedom.
The Fair Use Project itself, obviously by its name, suggests what its main focus is. So before we get into discussing the Fair Use Project itself and some of its goals, for the benefit of the listeners who have not or are not familiar with the doctrine, since we do have an hour, although we have about 45 minutes really with the breaks, I don't want to cut you short. If you could describe for the listeners what fair use is and your perspective on it, that would be wonderful.
Absolutely. If you think of copyright law as a series of restrictions on what you can do with copyrighted material, you should think of fair use as an exception to those restrictions that lets you use copyrighted material without anybody's permission in certain circumstances. There are a variety of circumstances where fair use comes into play. The copyright law spells some of them out. It, for instance, specifies that fair use helps protect your right to conduct scholarship, research, and the like. But it doesn't stop there with those statutory categories. The strength and the weakness of fair use is it's broad and even vague. And so while there are lots of things specified that it protects, things decided in the case law already, it's not a laundry list of things. The punchline is it protects your right to do something new with copyrighted material, to transform it, to create something that gives it new meaning. And that's really what fair use is all about, is the right to take what's come before and do something new and transformative with it.
And just for clarity, it's anything that can be copyrighted or is copyrightable is subject to the fair use doctrine.
Absolutely. And a lot of people think of fair use as a defense to
right.
copyright, and I actually don't think that's right. If you look at the way the statute is set up, Section 106 says here's what copyright covers, subject to 107, which is fair use, and says all this stuff is excluded. So when you are making fair use of something, you got yourself out from under the copyright protections.
Is the fair use doctrine itself, I don't want to get very, very legal here, because the audience is quite broad, but I do think we should ask. When we're talking about fair use, we're talking about federal law, something that's codified in the law, but is subject to various interpretations, and maybe it would be helpful to kind of give your perspective on where you think the courts generally, and I'm speaking extremely broadly here, and if you need to parse it, that's fine, but where the courts are on fair use today.
Well, to figure out where they are, I think it helps to look back at where it all came from. Mm-hmm. It originated as a common law doctrine, and the courts developed sort of four factors they look at, which are pretty sensible, I think. They make up a pretty sensible framework to assess the fair use issue. And the way it works is the first thing you look at is what you're doing with the copyrighted material, that is, the nature of the use you're putting it to. And the critical question there is whether it's transformative or not. Mm-hmm. It also matters whether you're trying to make a profit on it or not, but not as much as it used to.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing you look at is how much of the copyrighted work are you using? If you're using just a little bit, you're better off. That's not to say you can't use the whole thing. In some circumstances, you can, especially when the whole point of your new work is to perhaps comment on the original. To do that, lots of times you have to use the entire original.
Mm-hmm.
The next factor you look at, number three, is the nature of the work you're borrowing from. If you're borrowing from historical and factual works, your fair use rights are stronger because everybody needs more leeway to discuss factual events and history and things that happen, and nobody should be able to lock those up through copyright protection. If you're talking about using fictional or creative works, it's not to say fair use protection is thin, but it's not quite as broad as it is when you're talking about factual works. The final factor you look at is what effect is your use having on the market for the original?
Mm-hmm.
Is somebody likely to substitute your new use for the original? Are you going to somehow impinge on the market for the original, whether by direct substitution or other ways.
When we say transformative, that's a word which I think requires a little bit of thought. Give me an example or a couple of examples of what would be a transformative use of a copyrighted material.
Sure, I can give you lots. I think, you know, maybe one of the most well known is a use that really brought this issue to the fore in the U.S. Supreme Court when it looked at A Two Life Crew song, which was a parody of the Roy Orbison song Pretty Woman. Mm-hmm. There's a clean version and a dirty version, and it was you could call it a parody, but it was a remake, and yeah, there were some elements of parody in it. But fundamentally, the court said, look, what we care about is whether you're doing something new. Are you trying to create something that expresses new meaning, new thoughts, and sort of redefines the original? Are you commenting on it? Is it a parody? And the court held that the critical question in fair use is what you're doing with it. Are you trying to give it new meaning and turn it into something that didn't exist before? Mm-hmm. So when they looked at this song that was a parody, and you could argue about whether it was a good one or a bad one,
right,
they said, look, you know, they're trying to do something new here. They're poking fun at it. It's not meant to substitute for the original. So let's forget about the fact they're doing it entirely for profit, because lots of people do lots of creative things for profit. Mm-hmm. What we really care about is whether you are transforming it into something new and different.
I think it's an important point, the for-profit aspect, because certainly when I discuss fair use issues with people generally, especially people who aren't lawyers, you often hear the retort when someone says, this is fair use or this is protected, they say, and I'm not trying to make a buck off of this. We're not, when we talk about the market being impacted, I guess I want to focus there a little bit, because I think there's a misconception out there. We're talking about fair use in terms of whether the public would be, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but whether the public would be confused by or think that this is one and the same with the copyrighted work, when in fact, that is as far as the analysis goes. We're not talking about the idea that someone can transform a copyrighted work and make a ton of money off of it, and therefore it doesn't fall under the fair use exception. Am I right generally in making that statement?
Well, there's two ways I would refine that.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, the market effect is not about whether somebody is confused about the source of the work. In other mm-hmm. words, it wouldn't matter if listeners thought that the Two Life Crew song was somehow endorsed or perhaps blessed by Roy Orbison.
Mm-hmm.
That's what trademark law does.
Mm-hmm.
The question for fair use is whether you are likely to buy or use or substitute the new work for the old one.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to buy the Two Life Crew song instead of the Roy Orbison song? Well, probably not. So that's one way to refine.
Unless you have very eclectic musical taste.
Very eclectic, yeah. The other way I would refine what you said is if you are undertaking something that's highly transformative, the fact you're making a profit for it or not generally won't stop you or automatically make the world safe for you. It's one factor the court considers. It used to be the factor that mattered the most. And if you look at most of the fair use decisions before the Supreme Court decided the Two Life Crew case, they almost always rose and fell on whether or not the person coming along with the new work was making a profit or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a sea change in fair use law when the Supreme Court said, no, that's not the point. The point is, are you doing something new and transformative and giving the old work new meaning? And so it really kind of unleashed the fair use doctrine, which paved the way for much, much broader application over the last, 15 or 20 years.
A tangentially related area and what I want to discuss before we get into the specifics of the fair use project is digital rights management and the whole issue of the copyright holders or the content industry or whatever phrase you want to use severely limiting or completely limiting or in one way or another controlling how one uses their copyrighted work. Where does DRM fit in your view in the whole debate about fair use generally?
Well, it plays a prominent role in trying to sort all this out. Before I get to that, mm-hmm. I think it would be useful to give some examples of some of the types of things, at least digitally and online, that
right.
fair use would protect.
Sure.
There are tons of things you see up there on YouTube where People are fiddling around, and maybe they make their own music video with their favorite song, and it's just some kind of goofy homemade thing that all the 35 people watch. Mm-hmm. But every once in a while, somebody does something that's just flat out magical. And some great examples of that that I particularly like are about 6 or 8 months ago, somebody took the song Endless Love, that cheesy duet from 1980, whatever it was.
Right.
And what they did is they took press conference footage from George Bush and Tony Blair and set that to music. But the genius of it was they found footage where they were actually mouthing the words to the song.
Right.
And they cut it in such a way so that it really looked and felt like they were singing this love duet to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it was brilliant. And that's a great example of what fair use lets you do. Another example I really like is the Obama ad that went around the internet about 2 months ago, where somebody took the Apple commercial from the 1984 Super Bowl,
mm-hmm.
the George Orwell, Fritz Lang Metropolis takeoff.
Yeah.
And they kind of recut it and recast it as a Barack Obama ad where Hillary took the place of the dystopian dictator. And it was Hillary that the crowd was being liberated from. And so they're borrowing on all sorts of levels. They're borrowing from the Fritz Lang film. They're borrowing from the George Orwell novel. They're borrowing from the Apple commercial. And it's a powerful example of fair use, because I think in that situation, appropriating material has the ability to create meaning that you probably couldn't create any other way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and those are great examples, and it reminds me of another genre of what I think are very creative works that are being done, the mashups, where people are taking film, Trigger Zone and Killer Zone, and recasting them in an entirely different light. And the first one that I saw, which I don't want to add a legal opinion, but it seems clearly fair use, was one where someone took Psycho, the Jack Nicholson film, and recut it as a wacky love story involving his wacky dad and wacky son, complete with a recut that involved playing Peter Gabriel's Salisbury Hill as they drive away into the prairie. Now, of course, the Psycho film, as we know, has nothing to do with those kinds of things, except in the most perverse sense. And yet, there, we're not talking about political commentary. We're not, in the examples that you use, we're talking simply about what I view, and this is obviously all this is subjective, as creativity. But there, again, to get back to your transformative idea, that would generally be fair use. Am I right about that?
I don't want to suggest that you that to exercise your fair use rights, you need to be saying something important or political,
right?
Or doing anything except messing around and having fun.
Right.
Creativity takes endless forms, and there's absolutely nothing in the fair use doctrine that says what you're doing has to be meaningful or important or weighty. And absolutely, it protects your right to have fun. And if you're being creative and transformative, and you're not affecting the market for the original, and you're using small bits, you bet. All sorts of stuff up on YouTube, I think, is protected by fair use, and we could probably go through endless examples.
Right.
And so, there are a lot of great examples that are just, fun and get lots of laughs, and maybe they say something at the same time. But there are also lots of examples where it does protect very important rights.
Mm-hmm.
Academic scholarship is a big deal. That's what the Schloss case was about.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many instances where fair use rights are central to saying very important things. And so there's a fun component, a funny component, a silly component, but there's also a very serious component.
And then turning to the Fair Use Project itself, with that background, what is it? What are its goals?
So the main goals of the Fair Use Project are to litigate cases that present important fair use issues, and we want to define fair use better so it's clearer before the fact, so people feel more comfortable using it, but also expand it and cover some things, make sure that it covers things that maybe it's not so clear right now that it covers. A lot of the stuff happening on the internet is a great example.
Mm-hmm.
You asked about DRM a little while ago, and it occurs mm-hmm. to me I never quite got to my answer to that.
Thank you for coming back.
And I want to speak to that, because DRM fits in here in a very important way. And the reason for that is, if you lock up content behind a vault the way DRM does, then you can't get your hands on the material to exercise your fair use rights, or any rights for that matter, in the first place. And that's a big problem. So it's an access issue. If you don't have access to the stuff in the first place. You can't do anything with it. But there is some reason for optimism on that subject. You started to see cracks in that wall. And, you know, I don't mean to suggest that DRM is a bad thing mm-hmm. overall. It served a very useful purpose because I think without it, we may still not have music labels and movie studios releasing their content digitally mm-hmm. over the Internet the way they now have. And I think it was sort of a palliative to, you know, help them put their toe in that water. And now you're starting to see some of them say, well, maybe we're better off without it. EMI, I think it was, has mm-hmm. now announced that they're going to release their whole catalog on iTunes without DRM. I don't think it's a coincidence that that happens now that digital fingerprinting technology is developing and giving content owners a better chance to identify infringements after the fact. Mm-hmm. That being so, they're less worried about locking it up before the fact, which I think is great because if you do lock it up before the fact, it stops people from doing all kinds of amazing creative things, and I hope it disappears.
Well, that DRM issue, which I want to come back to, but it's a good time for it, also has some relevance today because Amazon today announced that they were going to come out sometime, I guess, in the fall with a direct competitor to iTunes, a music store, where they've said they are going to sell all of their music without DRM. Now, it's interesting because you mentioned EMI's willingness to do it on iTunes. It seems like there may be some – obviously, they have some recordings. It's unclear which ones. But it does raise the issue, again, getting back to fair use, of what the music industry's interest is here in making sure that DRM, in fact, survives. And I guess I'll ask you, from a fair use perspective, in your view, how effective has DRM been – in stopping what would otherwise be fair uses? Is there, and that's a hard question, is do you have any sense of that? Is there any data out there? I mean, what's your observation, if nothing else, on that question?
You know, it's just so hard to answer and probably impossible to say. The real irony is that one thing DRM is clearly very bad at is stopping piracy.
Right.
The fact is, and especially in the world of music, the fact is that anybody who wants to go out there and become a serious pirate is going to do it with CDs. Mm-hmm. Easy to get. And even if they don't want to do it with CDs, it's not exactly tough to get on the Internet and find the programs you need to crack any encryption you want to crack, whether that be the old DVD encryption or the brand new encryption for Blu-ray technology. It's out there, and if you want to crack it, you can crack it. If somebody wants to pirate the stuff, they're going to do it. So DRM doesn't do much of anything to deter any serious piracy. I do think it has been regrettably effective in deterring fair use. Now, it's hard to – you can't point to anything because guess what? The stuff never got made.
Right.
So how do you prove –
proving the negative.
DRM stopped it. You
yeah,
can't
yeah.
prove that negative. But
yeah.
the fact is what DRM does is it prevents the casual user from getting his or her hands on something. And I think it's the casual user now who is creating this amazing wealth of original and creative content that we see on so many platforms, YouTube included.
And the issues with DRM and fair use also seem to go, you know, really go to the heart of what we're doing with this content because, you know, as you know, it was just, I guess, February that Steve Jobs came out and said that he, in fact, doesn't view DRM as necessary. Now, Apple, of course, has various business reasons for why they want that, but the interesting thing that he pointed out in his statement he made on the issue was that there's I don't have the article in front of me, but it was something around 3% of music sales that he identified were through iTunes where DRM exists. His point was that 97%, and again, the number, I think that was the number, 97% of music out there are sold on CDs where he pointed out there is no DRM. So it's kind of an interesting issue that DRM, as we talk about, at least with the music perspective, is, in his view, relatively minor in terms of its even ability as an as a force to impact creation. And proving the negative, of course, is an unfair question. It's about as unfair as the question that I often ask people, which is to predict the future, which is always fun for a radio show and fun for me sitting on this side of the microphone. I won't ask you to do that now. And in fact, what I will ask you to do is to sit tight, and we'll take a short music break at this point, and before coming back and talking on the other side of the half hour about the Fair Use Project itself and some of the things that you're working on. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. I happen to know that part of the benefit of working with someone is that I know a little bit more about them than normal guests, and I know that Tony is a jazz fan, so I decided that I'd throw some jazz in of various genres today. But before we return to the conversation with Tony Falzone, director of the Fair Use Project at Stanford Law School, I do want to do, as I always do, live or recorded at the bottom of the hour, and begin my plea for money. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station that relies on donations from listeners to keep its wide variety of programming, from sports to music to talk, on the air. If you're interested in considering, or in fact just skipping the consideration altogether and going straight to giving, you have a couple of options. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. But regardless, I do ask you to keep listening, and indeed stay tuned at about a half hour from now, 6 o'clock, Benji with Tripping Over Zero. So we're back with Tony Falzone. And Tony, before the break, I mentioned we would get into some of the specifics of the Fair Use Project. So maybe we could start right off with, I think, a project before we get to some of the cases, which is a documentary film project, something that's been publicized. Why don't we talk a little bit about that and how, again, how that connects to the fair use issues that you want to deal with?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. It's something that has been very exciting for us. What quickly became apparent to Larry Lessig, my boss, as he started to work with documentary filmmakers, is there was a huge gulf between the fair use rights the law said you have and your ability to actually make a film that exercises those rights. And the reason was because as soon as you try to convince anybody to distribute your film so it sees the light of day, they start asking you about permissions and clearances, and did you pay for that? Did you license it? And, well, no, I got the fair use right to use it. Well, the distributor doesn't want to put his or her neck on the line, so they'd rather have you clear it, or better yet, go buy an insurance policy, and if you go do that, and you mentioned fair use in the past, they would convene a room full of lawyers for several days,
right,
and your policy would be priced accordingly. So we saw that as a real problem, and documentary film is a medium that relies especially heavily on fair use because it's talking about the world around you. And guess what? A lot of the world around you is captured, contained, and defined by copyrighted content. So we decided we're going to try to solve that problem, and I think we've gone a long way towards doing it. We convinced a very forward-thinking and sophisticated insurance company called Media Professional, which is the largest insurer of media risks in the country, to change the way it writes errors and omissions policies for filmmakers. And the big change is what they decided to do is go out on what other people considered a limb, cover the fair use so long as the filmmaker is working with a lawyer that MediaPro trusts and follows the advice and directions of that lawyer as to fair use issues. Mm-hmm. And that streamlines the process fantastically and really opens the door for filmmakers to make films that rely, in fact, on fair use. And so we've had a great response to that. We're getting several films a week now. We've had the chance to work with some fantastic films. One was called Bling, which showed in a shortened form on VH1 a few months back. And it is a film about violence and jewelry and diamonds and hip-hop and their real-life effects in Sierra Leone. And it does some really interesting things with fair use. One of the things it does is it goes back and traces the rise of the iconography of jewelry and diamonds and gold and hip-hop music and hip-hop videos. And, you know, it isolates, you know, it starts with, you know, Run DMC in that era with the big gold ropes. It isolates the first time somebody said bling in a song, the first time somebody said bling in a video, and traces the whole history. And there's no way to do that, really, without fair use, because now all of a sudden you're showing about 25 clips from some of the most popular songs of all time. Mm-hmm. And so fair use was a critical, critical part of doing that. I'm working with another film that I think is really, really interesting. It's about violence in video games. And it's a very detailed investigation with lots and lots of screenshots, live action, you know, full animation, screenshots from the games they're talking about while the commentators are discussing the game. So you've got this really neat multimedia overlay where you have the interview subjects speaking and the video game he or she is actually analyzing playing in the background. So, you know, for a 90-minute movie, I would say copyrighted content shows up for about, well, I don't know, 83 minutes of it. Try doing that without fair use. Just not possible. So we've been very happy because we feel like we've helped films get out there that might not otherwise have gotten out there without this program.
This is an unusual interview because I, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, and I should mention again, I work for Tony Falzone as a resident fellow at CIS. But having said that, I mean, it is a great project, and it kind of, I do want to ask a question which I think some, again, garners some confusion among people, and to the extent that people challenge the fair use doctrine, they make this point, which basically boils down to this. Is fair use, and I'm asking it really in a theoretical way, but I'll pose it this way. Is fair use a substitution for asking for permission? In other words, there are times where one could get permission and have to skip this. Or are we, when we talk about fair use, we're not talking about, and I'm asking a bit of a loaded question, but we're not talking about a way for people to simply get around going through the formalities, and obviously we're not talking about fair use as a way to cover up piracy and just straight up theft. Where does the permission culture of property generally intersect with the fair use doctrine?
So that's a good question. And one thing you said I want to make crystal clear. Fair mm-hmm. use has just nothing whatsoever right. to do with piracy or file sharing right. or peer-to-peer anything.
Which is a big misconception as well, I think.
Absolutely. Fair use does not protect your right to, you know, go download your favorite album from LimeWire. That's mm-hmm. Some people might argue it does. I don't know. I'm not going to take any position. I don't feel the need to. That's not something we concern ourselves with. Mm-hmm. We are concerned with people who are making use of copyrighted content to do new, creative, exciting, transformative and expressive things. And that's the heart of fair use. So you asked, is it a way around getting permission? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's one of the points of fair use, is it saves you the hassle and the transaction cost of having to go ask permission from somebody. And, you know, keep in mind that it is very often not a matter of asking one or two people, mm-hmm. but in many of the works or films we work with, we're talking about asking dozens, maybe scores, conceivably hundreds of people. There's a film that came out, I think, last year called This Film Is Not Yet Rated, mm-hmm. a documentary about Hollywood movies and the motion picture rating system. And that had hundreds and hundreds of clips from popular movies. And so the very act of going through the formalities of asking for permission probably would have taken months and who knows how many thousands of dollars. And the fair use is designed to excuse you from that burden on some level.
And another aspect of it, of course, is the fact that, as you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, which is the ability for the absence of fair use, or conversely, the ability of excessive need to get permission and clear rights to just kill a project. And the famous story that a lot of people are familiar with is on the documentary Eyes on the Prize about the Civil Rights Era, which I'm not sure of the current status of it, but the last I checked, still unavailable because of the need to clear rights for various popular songs from the 60s that are used as background in this piece, and the inability, basically, among other things, but the inability of the current holders of the documentary to get permission to reproduce it. And I think that's the kind of sad reality that the Documentary Film Project is designed to take up. Is in terms of cases, I do want to ask you briefly, in the time we have left about some of the leading cases, and you mentioned the Schloss case, and maybe this would be a good time to kind of discuss what was that case about and what is its significance in your view.
Sure. Carol Schloss is a professor here at Stanford University, and she set out a while back to write a book about Lucia Joyce, who is the daughter of the famous author James Joyce, and who spent most of her life in a mental institution and was, in some respects, a controversial figure and certainly a tragic figure. And when Carol looked into this further, she realized there was a lot more to Lucia's story than had been told. And so she felt she had to tell that story. And to tell that story, she spent an amazing amount of time doing some really incredible primary source research. She flew all around the world to archives all over the place to uncover material that had just, you know, fallen through the cracks to the sands of time. And when the estate of James Joyce got wind of this, they decided they want to stop it. They tried to thwart her at nearly every turn. She persevered, and when they found out the book was going to be published, they decided they'd try to stop that, too, by threatening both her and her publisher, mainly on copyright grounds. Mm-hmm. So this is a great example of where copyright law can have a very profound effect on scholarship. And although Carol succeeded in publishing the book, along the way, due to the copyright threats, a lot of the material was excised, some at the behest of her publisher and some just out of her own fear of the copyright issue. And finally, she decided that she wasn't content with that, and she wanted to restore the material and get it out there so people could hear the whole story. Mm-hmm. So she decided to take this material that had been excised and put it into an electronic supplement that would be published on the Internet. And when the estate got wind of that, they said, oh, no, you're not going to do that either. And they said, you know, again, that's an infringement of our rights. Don't do it. So that's where we came in. We decided that we would sue the Joyce estate, which we did, and ask the court for a declaration that Carol was within her rights under fair use to publish this stuff.
The and another area which this gets us into is the issue of scholarship generally. And again, to those that aren't familiar with the issue, they might wonder how fair use or how copyright would prevent general scholarship. So I think I want to ask you the broad question, which is getting back to the same similar kind of question I've asked before. How does fair use impact the ability of the scholar to, or anyone looking to disseminate information for educational purposes or for commentary purposes in the writing realm? Is it any different, or does it function any differently than in the music or film world that we've been discussing up to now?
Well, no, I don't think it functions any differently. I mean, one of the troubles is it used to be that you didn't receive copyright protection for something unless you actually asked for it. And you not only had to ask for it, you had to send a copy to the copyright office, you had to register the material, and then you had to renew it after a certain time period. That all got scrapped in 1976. And now, you know, the notes I'm doodling on my paper here in front of me are now copyrighted automatically for my lifetime and 70 years after that.
Right.
So as a result, this huge trove of information, not just related to scholars, but, you know, anybody who walked the earth
right.
in the last century
right.
is now under copyright control and probably still will be for quite some time. So anybody who wants to say anything about history, scholarship, writing can bump into copyright problems. Carol bumped into copyright problems when she wanted to print excerpts from James Joyce's diary and Lucia mm-hmm. Joyce's diary to illustrate some of her points. Mm-hmm. I've talked to other scholars who are trying to get access to all sorts of information or have accessed it and are now getting threats from the people who control the copyrights when they want to publish their work. And one of the strange things here is that if a foundation or an estate, let's say, donates something to a library, the physical document might sit there in the library, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean that the copyright follows it. So you may be able to walk into an archive and review all sorts of papers, notes, manuscripts, whatever, take all the notes you want. But when it comes time to publishing that, you still have to get permission of the copyright holder, whoever that may be. And that was exactly the problem that Carol ran into. I've talked to a number of other academics who are bumping into that problem now, and it's a big problem because it really hampers their ability to conduct the scholarship they want to conduct and say what they want to say about leading figures in history, literature, music, art, you name it.
Does the Orphan Works issue, and the few, we have about 5 minutes left, and the Orphan Works issue, how does that factor into, if it does, the problems that you're confronting from either in a documentary film project or in a litigation perspective? In other words, does the absence of the ability for older works that might be used in a documentary film, does the absence of the ability to find out who in fact might hold a copyright impact the fair use analysis? Or from a practical perspective, does the inability to identify a copyright holder impact the creative process from what you've seen?
Well, there's no doubt that it impacts the creative process. It doesn't really affect the fair use analysis. A copyrighted work is subject to the same fair use analysis whether you can find the owner or not.
Mm-hmm.
But where it really affects the work is if you want to do something that might require permission.
Yeah.
And there is just a tremendous number of works out there that remain under copyright protection, but you have no idea who the owner is, you have no idea who to ask. And part of the problem is it may be hard to figure out, A, if they're under copyright protection at all. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. Let's say you go use it and somebody comes out of the woodwork and sues you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of disconcerting to most people to face that kind of lack of certainty. So it's a big problem, and I think it cuts across many, many genres.
The in closing, in the last few minutes here, I do want to kind of do a little bit of crystal ball, but really, first of all, just ask what projects are coming down the pike. What kind of things do you see the Fair Use Project focusing on in the short term, and perhaps, if you can, in the long term?
Scholarship in academia is very important to us. There are lots more situations out there like Carol's, and mm-hmm. we want to help as many of those folks as we can. I think another big, big issue is going to be in the political space as the presidential election revs up towards 2008. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be fascinating to watch because...
Especially if there's 10 candidates running on the Republican side. That'll make it all the more exciting.
And you have to remember that in the last presidential election, YouTube literally did not exist.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a revolution since that time in the digital tools available to create content and the platforms available to share it. And I think an issue that sort of galvanizes the country and catches its collective attention the way a presidential election will is going to harness those tools like never before. And you're going to see just a flurry and a blizzard of content, kind of like the Apple Obama ad. There are already, a variety of channels on YouTube dedicated to political issues. Bill Richardson is running his insurgency campaign largely on YouTube.
Right.
And I think it's going to be fascinating to watch. And we also care about the fun stuff. You're right to horse around and do silly things on YouTube. We just finished litigating a case against Viacom mm-hmm. on behalf of Robert Greenwald's organization. We did that case with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who just does fantastic work in this area too. And that case concerned a clear parody that Greenwald made of the Colbert Report.
Hmm.
Much to our pleasure, Viacom was actually rather contrite about what happened, agreed it should be back up, and now we're talking to them about how we might put together some rules of the road to prevent that kind of thing from happening again.
At the risk of, since we're both litigators, at the risk of asking a question that would be a horror scenario for a litigator if they want to continue litigating, it does lead to the question of how much communication do you sense that there is between the copyright holders and the creators on these issues? I mean, we see a lot of fluidity even now in terms – I mean, just the iTunes a job statement with regard to DRM suggests that there is at least – it appears to be a little bit more of a debatable topic than it was even a year ago. Do you have a sense of how much discussion is happening at the high levels to kind of break the ice a little bit and reach some kind of agreements, if they're possible, on the parameters of fair use?
Yeah, I think that what's happened is that with the digital content platforms like YouTube that exist now, creativity has become so much more a part of popular culture. We're now used to consuming things that might have been made by the kid down the street, whereas 5 or 10 years ago, the only things we were consuming were made by movie studios and record labels and big companies. So we are much more attuned to the need to protect creative freedom because we're digesting the products of it all the time. And I think that popular consciousness of it has sort of permeated every level, and CEOs of big media companies are not immune to that. And I think that there is just more consciousness of the issue. Now, that's not to say we've gotten anywhere near where we need to go in terms of receptiveness. I think that a lot of companies remain very, very overzealous in the way they protect and enforce their IP rights. And I hope that'll change. I think it'll take a while for it to change. But I think there's a consciousness there that at least paves the way to move the ball forward a little bit in that direction.
And obviously, you know, I'm about the least objective interviewer you could possibly have for this topic to say that I certainly wish you luck in those efforts. And even though I'll be leaving Stanford, I will continue to be involved as a non-resident fellow and hope to be able to be involved in these battles. Because at the end of the day, the fair use doctrine itself is ultimately, as you mentioned, about the ability for people to create new works. And in the absence of permission, the fact that work could not be done would be a very bad thing for society generally. So I certainly hope that this project continues to plow forward in that area.
That's right. And fair use is free speech. Don't forget that.
Right. Yeah. And at the end of the day, which is I think a good way actually to theme to end today on. For those people that want to learn more about the Fair Use Project or perhaps reach out, they can go to the CIS website, correct, at cyberlaw.stanford.edu.
Absolutely.
Terrific. And do you have any other suggestions on resources or ways that people can learn more about fair use generally?
There are a lot of good resources out there. The Center for Social Media has a ton of really excellent resources, many of which are focused on documentary film. I think that's a great resource. Stanford actually has, through its libraries, a very good fair use resource, too.
Hmm.
And there's the Fair Use Network out in New York. Electronic Frontier Foundation is, without a doubt, a leader in this field, too. And they have lots and lots of content on their site about fair use and other digital freedom issues, broadly speaking. And they do a great job of keeping it very current, very up to date. And there's just lots of great stuff there. So all those organizations, I would encourage people to go visit and check out and learn from.
Terrific. Tony Falzone, I want to thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, taking the trek across campus from the law school. I want to thank Tony Falzone, again, the director of the Fair Use Project at Stanford, for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Fair use is a very controversial doctrine. I don't think it's any secret to any of the listeners of Hearsay Culture where I come down on it. But I'm very happy to have Tony on to discuss the Fair Use Project and the work that the Fair Use Project is doing. I'm excited to mention again that the show will continue uninterrupted, if all goes well, right through the summer and into the fall. Even though I am leaving my full-time job at Stanford to join the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina as a professor, Hearsay Culture will continue in its current format on KZSU as well as through the various ways that you can find the show by podcast, which is either by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu and going to the RSS podcast feed, or by going to the Hearsay Culture website, hearsayculture.com, and finding the show there. And finally, you can also find the show by going to the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society, which if you just click on podcasts in iTunes and type Center for Internet and Society, you will find Hearsay Culture. Next week, I will be having a pre-recorded show interview with Jennifer Granick, who's the executive director of CIS, and Brad Stone, who's a technology reporter for the New York Times, on robotics and their fascinating trip to Japan that they took last summer. And then at the end of the month, I will have on, again, also live, Professor Michael Shanks of the Metamedia Lab here at Stanford. I've posted the schedule going straight through the summer, straight into August, in fact, on hearsayculture.com, where you can find not only the schedule but also all of the previous shows in that format, in addition to the other places I've mentioned. So I want to thank you for listening today to Hearsay Culture. Please stay tuned to KZSU for Benji and Tripping Over Zero. I'm going to attempt to mollify the gods that would be horrified at cutting off Thelonious by actually going back to Thelonious on the way out of the show. So this is Dave Levine and Hearsay Culture on KZSU. Thank you for listening today, and I'll look forward to talking to you next week.